Cultures around the world have always looked to nature as a source of both increased health and wellness. While modern science continues to support this connection, we spend the majority of our time indoors. Welcome to the Nature of Wellness podcast, where we explore the relationship between the natural world and the human experience. Join us as we discuss all things nature, health, and well-being. We truly believe the future of health is now. Welcome to another episode of the Nature of Wellness podcast. I'm Dr. Mark Campbell, and with me is one of my favorite people, someone who could stand as strong as a mountain, flow like a river, someone who leads with his heart, my favorite co-host on the planet, Mr. Steve Otero. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you so much for that lovely intro, Mark. How are you?
Absolutely. I'm good. I got a little feedback after the last one because it was a little short and serious, but that's how I was feeling about you for the day. So I'll go back to long-winded and funny.
Well, I love you too.
I love you too, buddy.
I keep it simple.
Everything is truth, man. I've seen you stand as strong as a mountain. I've seen you flow around things. You always lead with your heart, which is so needed and wonderful these days. So I never want to miss a chance to hold the mirror up and show you what's there, buddy. How's everything out there?
Everything's good. We continue to get snow, which, you know, keeps me very, very happy. The way things look, we should have a nice long meltout all throughout the entire month of May. I mean, you know, where I live, I've got snow on the ground. I can go find snow at the end of June, beginning of July, usually. So, you know, I'm very, very excited about that. Hopefully that will keep our water monsters calm and cool and collected. You know, there's a lot of controversy, unfortunately, about the Colorado River these days. And so, you know, my number one concern is just keeping it as full as possible. So that way folks can get the water they need. Our farmers can grow what they need to grow. I can still eat avocados in the off season. I'm being selfish there, I know, but I do love a good avocado.
Amen, brother.
You know, so yeah, we're living well out here. How's the East Coast?
Oh, it's good. You know, we're fully in spring now. It's been spring for a couple of weeks and out on the trails more, so many more people outside recreating, trying to do more fishing. Sometimes life gets in the way, but any day I can be waist deep in the river is a good day. But trying to get on the trails more, man, trying to diversify a little bit, leading more group work on trails, a lot more client work on trails, which is nice. And you know, I mentioned a couple episodes ago about the historian in the local state park. I've really taken a deep dive into the history of that area and the history of the land. And it's really cool to be able to educate folks while we're out there, you know, what was there, how the land has recovered from what was there, you know, in the early 1900s. How resilient nature is, which is always a great teaching point. And, you know, just because something is now doesn't mean it always will be that. And we talked last episode with Dr. Lim about change and how change is going to happen with or without us. And it's always kind of nice to have a little hand in saying what happens with that change, being proactive.
The earth finds a way.
That's it. The Gaia theory.
With or without us, the earth finds a way.
That's it. It's so funny. Time just keeps moving with or without us, right? So it's up to us to really make our impact while we're here and, you know, ask for what we need when we need something. That's such a big topic. And that's something I've been talking about a lot lately. My mind gets boggled sometimes. I think about kids, you know, and kids don't have the biases. They aren't skewed in their thinking like we are. If a kid needs something, they ask for it and they don't worry about what their friends are going to think or their peers or, you know, if a small child is hungry, they ask for food. If they're thirsty, they ask for water. And somewhere along the way, we start feeling guilty about asking for help. And that's, I don't understand that. I mean, I get it. Media representation of asking for help is sort of all over the place. It makes us feel soft or weak.
Ego.
Ego gets involved. You know, hero worship folks that our perception of them is that they're lone wolves, that they take on the world by themselves, that they're mentally tough. And I know that you and I both have been very fortunate to work with some of the most mentally tough, you know, hardest people on the planet. But I'm pretty confident in saying, and I'm sure you would agree with this, they're only that way because of the people and the support that they've had along the way.
Yeah, the people to the left and their right all the time.
Exactly. So looking for the help that you need and asking for the help that you need is so critical for us as a species. And that dang stigma that just keeps hanging around, I can't wait till that gets crushed, you know, and asking for help should never be weaponized, but one easy entry point into getting the help you need is to really look at getting outside and looking at nature and looking at the benefits of the things we talk about all the time: full spectrum light, fresh air, clean water, plant-based diet, all of the things that we talk about, physical activity outside, which I know we're going to talk about today. I'm really excited about. One aspect of recovery that we haven't talked about is addiction. And I know that that's a big topic. I know it was big before the pandemic. I'm sure those numbers are much higher post-pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, you know, unfortunately, right, substance use has grown in a variety of circles. While substance use is down, actually, for younger people, or younger people under the age of 26, with some of the latest statistics that I've been reading, right, younger people are choosing to utilize alcohol less and less. Thank goodness. I'm a champion of that choice. You know, addiction is a very, very wide-reaching topic, right? Addiction knows no boundaries, right? Addiction doesn't care if you're rich or poor. Addiction doesn't care if you've got a helicopter or if you live in a cardboard box. Addiction touches any and every family across the spectrum of all of our humanities. So, you know, I mean, it's an unfortunate challenge that we face in a variety of ways, right? And I want to make sure to make a statement, right? Like, addiction is not simply substances, right? We do focus on it. We focus on substance use and the substance component of addiction. People's addictive behaviors span well beyond substance use, right? And so, you know, people can get addicted to just about anything. And if we have a mask of health, maybe coding our addiction, it could actually prevent us from gaining additional support services that might help us actually address the addictive behaviors themselves, you know, because unfortunately I do know a lot of people that have gone from being addicted to substances to being addicted to physical activity. And that has actually made their relationships suffer. They've lost husbands, wives, et cetera. They've spent less time with their children. And so even that can be a potentially negative influencer on somebody's overall life success and balance of relationships. So, you know, and I live in a community, right, where people, like, I mean, you can't throw a stone without hitting somebody who runs ultra marathons where I live. You can't throw a stone about hitting somebody who has the ability to throw on skis and skins, and they can skin 50 miles across the mountaintops and high five and, you know, chug three beers after. So we have a very, very, you know, active community, but we also have a very, very addicted community in a variety of ways other than just substances. You know, we normalize excessive alcohol consumption in the athlete communities. Cycling has definitely been a division of sport that I've seen a lot of interesting sort of substance consumption behaviors, because, you know, so many people are so wildly fit and they can ride a bike for 150 miles and, you know, barely break a sweat. And so then afterwards they justify the consumption of 35 beers. I don't know if maybe in some ways they are justified. I don't know. Maybe they somehow are able to find balance in their relationships as well. You know, good for them if they are. I would argue that they're the outliers. Right? They're the tiny, tiny, minute sort of percentage of humans who are able to, you know, to do that.
Well, it's a slippery slope too.
Yeah. And that's really, I think, the ultimate sort of comment that I would have on it is this, you know, we've all got to be as honest as we can about our behavior patterns and choices and selections of activities. Cause, you know, coming out of the military, right? I could trade one addiction for another, you know,
and a lot of folks do, Steve.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, there's a lot of cautionary tales. There's a lot of tales of success, you know, but the brain's the brain, right? If we really like something and we gain pleasure out of it, well, the little voice in the back of our head is going to say, hey, let's go do that again. And then let's go do it again, even more and even longer and even more and even longer, right? Part of my own sort of addiction story is tied into the feelings of being strapped into a Black Hawk helicopter at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. There was just no more addictive feeling to me in life than that. And, you know, that was all centered in my own focus or desire for power and control, right? For a sense of autonomy in my existence at the time. But I didn't realize just how terribly that was affecting me until I got out of the military. And some of the behavioral desires that I had, I couldn't scratch that itch anymore. I had to go to therapy. I had to get some good counseling. I had to go spend some time outside to figure that part of myself out and to admit to myself, hey, this was a series of addictive behaviors that negatively impacted my life. And once I was able to look back and assess, then I was truly able to move forward. It's hard to do.
Well, you know, and I think you're a great example of what's possible. And I know that I've mentioned several times on the show, and I talk about you often, with the fact that you tried a lot of different therapies, and it wasn't until you added nature into the mix that you really started seeing growth and change. And there's actually a growing body of evidence that manipulating your environment, give yourself more access to green space, blue space, and nature could serve as a potential adjunct treatment to standard talk therapy, pharmacology, different forms of therapies. By targeting multiple biological and behavioral mechanisms, the standard pharmacotherapies don't address. And we know that there's effects of different full spectrum light exposures to pain, and effects of nature on mental and physical health, and green space, and any sort of social connection, and pro-social behavior, and cravings. So the science is there. The science is backing it up. So I would plead to anybody listening, first, if you need help, ask for help. There's nothing weak about asking for help. That's actually the toughest thing you can do, is to say there's something that I need to work on and I need help doing it. And number two, if there is some sort of an issue, talk to a provider and ask about adding nature into it. And we say at the end of the show, in our outro, this isn't meant to change your relationship with your provider. You know, we're not medical providers in the traditional sense. We just want to help you create new conversations with your providers that allow you to get more out of what you need for healing and recovery and being at your best consistently. And Steve, if you're okay with it, this is a perfect opportunity to segue into today's guest, who I'm super excited to talk to today. This is somebody I met a few years ago at the National Wellness Conference. He keynoted there. I was just in awe the entire time. And I was like, man, who is this dude with tennis shoes on up here on stage talking to us about running long distances? And by the end, I was like, oh man, I want to run. And if you know me at all, that's probably words I haven't said very often in my life. I'm not a runner. I'm a power athlete. That's what I say, at least, Steve. But I wanted to get out and run after hearing his story. And I've wanted to have him on the show this whole time. Luckily, we've been able to make it work out schedule-wise. So today's guest is Charlie Engel. Charlie is one of the world's most accomplished ultra runners and adventure racers. He's won grueling endurance events on nearly every continent. In 2007, Charlie set a world record by running 4,500 miles across the Sahara Desert. The transcontinental run was documented in Running the Sahara, a film produced and narrated by Matt Damon. In conjunction with the run, Charlie formed the nonprofit H2O Africa, now water.org, which raised $6 million for clean water projects across Saharan Africa. While Charlie's running accomplishments are remarkable, the sport means much more to him than breaking records or winning races. Running has been a way of life, and during the darkest times, his salvation. It gave him the catalyst to break free of a decade-long addiction to drugs and alcohol. In the 26 years since Charlie took his last hit of crack cocaine, running has helped him stay sober, focused, and alive. And I'll stop there because I want him to talk more about his story. Welcome, Charlie. Thanks for being here today.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. And man, I meant everything I said. I couldn't wait to get you on the show. I know I've been bugging you for a while now to be a guest, and I know how busy you are. You're all over the world all the time. So thanks so much for taking a few minutes today to share your story and your work with the listeners.
It happens when it happens, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's absolutely. Today was the right day.
Absolutely. And I can't wait. It's a good day. So Charlie, if you don't mind, could you talk for a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are and what you're doing?
Yeah. First of all, I mean, thanks for that conversation. It was nice to just sit here and listen. There was a lot to unpack that you guys just talked about. So maybe we'll get to some of it. I've got thoughts. But, you know, my background is I'm 61 years old. You can tell I gave you a slightly outdated bio because I'm now 31 years sober. So that was my bad. But, you know, I grew up in North Carolina, which is where I'm talking to you from. You know, super hippie parents in the 60s, and my parents got divorced, you know, when I was a year or so old, and my dad went in the army, and, you know, I didn't see him for 6 years roughly. And, you know, those were unbeknownst to me, very formative years, you know, and we'll talk more about the effects on addiction and addictive behavior based on that kind of upbringing. But yeah, I went on to be an overachiever, and, you know, in school, and made good grades, and student body president and captain of some teams and dated some cheerleaders. And like, I did that. I did the whole thing and went to the University of North Carolina, fully expecting that I was going to be, you know, a star there. And it took like a day for me to understand just how average I was. And, you know, everybody there had the same resume as I did or better. And, you know, there were 4,000 other freshmen and I got lost. And one thing I didn't get lost in, or at least I took advantage of, was the fact that the drinking age was 18. And I figured out pretty quickly I was a, you know, first team All-American drinker. And I could just drink more than other people, which is not something to aspire to. The 80s are also known as the cocaine decade. So, you know, that sort of launched my drug and alcohol, you know, career, if you will. And it really, you know, it was a path I was just, you know, I was destined to take. And a lot of it was, you know, born in insecurity. And at 61 years old, I am still very much unpacking the genesis of my addictive behavior. But, you know, I've had a huge shift in the way that I look at that part of my personality and that those personality traits. And as Steve said earlier, you know, there are those that can take their addictive nature and point it towards physical things, and maybe it can be to an extreme. But what I have found is, generally speaking, that extreme is still far more productive and less dangerous than where they came from, if it was drugs and alcohol. And hopefully the, you know, this long-term metamorphosis takes place, which leads them to a better place of discovery in nature. As you guys both know, with me, I mean, nature is, I would argue that for a civilian, I've probably spent more nights outside than just about anybody you know.
Yeah. Well, I love seeing your updates on social media and different places. You're constantly everywhere doing everything outside and helping other people. And it's just so refreshing. And thank you for sharing your story. And I know that I kind of joked about the running part when I introduced you, but when we met, it really inspired me to share a little bit about my background with you. And I love that you just said you were a world-class drinker. How did you say that? You were first team All-American drinker?
First team, always.
I get that completely. Yeah. And that, you know, I share this once in a while in you know, specific company, but I've struggled with addiction throughout my life in different ways with different substances because of some issues I dealt with as a kid, as far as abuse and other things. And it was just a way for me to numb pain. And I was right there with you. I was a teammate of yours on that, you know, that All-American drinking team. And I spent more time trying to deliberately make that happen than to deliberately make my life better. And unfortunately, I had some people in my life that were contributing to that and wanted to see me at my worst because it helped them justify being at their worst. But luckily I had, and you know, I gave her a shout out in episode one, but I had a mom that just wouldn't give up on me and tried so many unconventional things to help me out. She was a nurse and, you know, she'd seen a lot of it. And finally, one day it sank in. And I said, okay, enough is enough. And I started really looking for help and looking for ways to be better. And honestly, I wanted to help other people. So what you just said, Charlie, about switching one addiction for another and that really helping to, you know, more of the productive area of addiction, you know, looking at physical activity or different things. If it gets to an extreme, yes, it can be bad, but hopefully it helps people want to grow in other ways and seek other types of development for themselves. Other ways to be better, to help more people. And, you know, I've seen that quite a few times over the years with people I've worked with. They start to understand that they can do more and it increases their self-efficacy. And then they start to feel valued, which is maybe one of the reasons that they sought substance abuse or different types of addiction before. They didn't feel like a valued member of society. They didn't feel good enough, dealt with past trauma. So once they started realizing that they were accomplished, that they could do more, they tried to do even more. And I love that so much. And thank you so much for sharing that part.
Yeah, well, there's no such thing as a successful person that doesn't have periods of great obsession in their life. You know, an obsession borders on, you know, addictive behaviors, yet obsession tends to be things that are, you know, productive based on society's viewpoint. So I view addiction and my own obsessive nature as like a superpower. If I don't do drugs and drink and I take that energy and I point it towards other things, then really there is no limit to what can be done. And I think that it's a reframing. Look, there's another thing that happens, and we need 5 hours to do this to unpack language. But the language of addiction and disease and you're broken and there's something wrong with you and all of this is this perpetual, you know, self-actualizing language that reinforces these negative stereotypes. And it's a really, you know, it's a complicated thing. You guys said one thing. I'm not saying I don't agree with it, but I will say in this age, there is nobody that doesn't know that there's help out there for them. I mean, you'd have to be living in a cave to not know that there are outlets. I mean, when I went to college in 1980, there was no such thing as a substance counselor on campus, or there was no therapist. Like, there was no nothing. Like, there literally was nowhere to go as far as I knew in my college career. Today, everyone knows, even, and not to step out of my lane, but even the military at least puts a little bit of lip service to trying to deal up front with some of the inevitable issues. The problem is, it's not enough. And it's not, you know, it's, you're asking people, in Steve's case, you know, I can tell, you know, you're asking people to do really hard, dangerous, scary, deadly type of activities, and then pretend to be normal when all of that is over. Or, you know, you're asking them, are you okay? Do you need help? And of course, most of them are going to say, yeah, I'm fine. And that's just the nature of it. It's like we need to institute things that are, you know, technically that are mandatory. And not, it's not a question. Like, everyone should have a debrief on their way out the door.
Yeah.
If you're leaving prison, rehab, or the military, like, you, there should be a counselor waiting for you.
Very similar.
Yeah, I would take that a step further and say for healthcare providers, it should be mandatory. For teachers, yeah, it should be mandatory. Social workers, mental health providers, yes, you know, this should be a normalized, this should be taught to kids in kindergarten. And then every year, as they're capable of learning more, you add more pieces to it so that it's just part of their conversation, part of their language, part of their lexicon. It's normalized so that you don't wait until they're in their late teens or mid-teens, is what I'm seeing now with my clients, and saying, you know, there's something wrong, we need to get you help. And then you're having to introduce that concept. So I agree with you. I think language matters, but I also think on the addiction front, we're really good at using language that kind of excuses it away sometimes. And I'm a very passionate fly angler. Depending on who you ask, I could be addicted to fly fishing. I love it. Anytime I have a free second, I would be out there waist deep. I talked about it earlier. I talk about, if you stand near me for 2 seconds, I'm going to probably talk about fly fishing or nature. So you have that thing that you're passionate about or you're obsessed with, or, you know, so words have meaning. I say it all the time on the show. It's one of the most powerful phrases I've ever learned in my life. Words have meaning. And until we can really get into the same book of music, we don't have to be on the same page. Same book of music about what terms mean, you know, what phrases mean, then we can really start approaching these concepts more accurately and really dedicating resources and research and focus in the right ways. But right now, we can't even agree on language most of the time. So I think that starting young, and I agree with you, there's more access. And I say this all the time in my wellness work. As at this point in our existence as a species, we have more access to resources than ever before. Instant resources. Pick up your phone, open an app, there it is. But we are the most unhealthy and unwell as a species than we've ever been. So there's a huge disconnect there. So even if, you know, how many people know that it's not good to eat fried foods and be sedentary and not smoke? All of us, because yeah, it's in our face all the time. But how many people are still sedentary, eating fried foods and smoking?
And how many people know you shouldn't stare at this for 8 hours a day, yet we all do it?
Yeah. I'm so glad you held your phone up, Charlie, because technology is an addiction.
100%.
And it helps us. We talk about it all the time. We wouldn't be doing what we're doing right now without technology. We wouldn't be getting these messages out to hopefully the people that need to hear it, without this form of technology. But as you're saying, looking at it for 8 hours a day, mindlessly scrolling, logging onto YouTube to look up one specific video, and then 8 hours later, you're still watching cats play piano. That's a problem. And then you start judging. You start judging how bad your life is. I'm doing air quotes for the listeners. How bad your life is because it doesn't look like the best 3 seconds of somebody else's entire life that they've posted on Instagram. You start comparing yourself, and that's when you start to lose. That's when you start to go down the rabbit hole and spiral. And then you start trying to find ways to cope with that. And they're not always effective. The ways are there. The resources are there. We just don't always know how to implement those resources. Steve, how many veterans know that there's a Veterans Affairs office somewhere near them, but how few actually take advantage of it?
Less than half of the entire veteran population alive even bothers to engage with the VA at all. Less than half.
But how many veterans know there's a VA?
Everybody's at least told it, but you know, in a military or veteran experience, right, when you're on your way out the door, and I don't know too many people who have had a different experience than this, but almost everybody that I've spoken to has said, like, look, I did my out processing stuff. I was supposed to have a 3-day class. Maybe I ended up going to 1 day because I was busy. I had other appointments. I was trying to pack my house. I was trying to ship my dog, all that other kind of stuff. And so even the supposed, you know, I'll do air quotes, even the mandatory transition assistance coursework or education we're supposed to be involved in, it doesn't look cookie cutter for all of us. It's not the same for all of us. The standards of the education are not the same at each location. You know, each educational provider is just different. And so there are many, many ways to get lost in the nuance of it. And people do tell me all the time, right? I mostly work with older veterans these days, at least in my day job. And almost all those older veterans say, I never knew the VA would help me with this. I never knew, right? There was never a guy like you when I got out of the military in the 70s or 80s or 90s. There was never anybody marketing services or assistance to me. And I had no idea that simply by earning a DD-214, right, which is a military discharge document, I had no idea that simply by earning that discharge document, I could go get some free glasses or some free healthcare or a checkup, you know, once a year. And so even with all the availability of potential support mechanisms or systems, we still do actually have a marketing problem and a challenge with getting folks to choose to engage, right? They may hear it, it might go in one ear and out the other, right? Like my mom used to tell me when I was a kid, the information might be put out there, and all of us who are very strong-willed and spirited about saying, hey, you know, I'm an advocate for this information. You need to trust me to believe in this information. There's all these support mechanisms out there for you. That doesn't actually mean that the audience is listening. No matter how savvy of a marketer you are, it doesn't mean our audience is actually able to synthesize the information beyond that initial contact, you know, with us as an educator. And so,
well, that one class, though, that very critical class might be one of 50 classes that somebody has to take as they transition out. And they're all important in their own way. So it's not, you know, maybe it's just becomes white noise, which is another problem that we have. We've talked about it on the show with
drinking from the fire hose.
Exactly, the fire hose. So, I mean, again, we have more resources and more access to resources than ever before. No one can ever deny that. But, you know, the fact that we don't know how to use them effectively, or the fact that there's so much what I'll call, again, I'll do air quotes, guruism that exists out there, it just becomes white noise. And you don't know what's good, what's not. You Google something and the first 5 pages are paid for. So it's really hard to know if it's accurate or not. So, you know, I agree with you completely, Charlie. I think that we should know, we do know, but people still aren't utilizing them the way that they could.
Yeah, I mean, you guys talked about stigma in the beginning, and I've worked on some huge anti-stigma campaigns, but I actually believe there's not, I can say as a very open person who struggled with drug addiction for years, I've been to prison, stigma is self-imposed very often, and it is kind of how we feel. Society rarely these days, if you're vulnerable as a human being and you share your story with other people, it is really rare to have people take that information and throw it back in your face. There's a much greater level of acceptance for most things these days. you know, one of the mistakes that I think we, especially with social media, which I have a total love-hate relationship there, mostly hate, but I have sponsors, I have responsibilities. I do unfollow anybody that I see three straight posts where their life is perfect. I just unfollow. I don't necessarily like block them or anything. It's just I'm not interested in seeing people who aren't sharing their honest existence. And in sobriety, there's a saying that I've used forever. It's called attraction rather than promotion. I think it's the spirit of how we actually get better at this as a society, but it takes people being willing to vulnerably share their own experiences. You've seen me speak on stage. I do not get on stage and say, you should, because I have no idea what you should do. People might even ask me, like, how do I do this? And even if it's a running question, I'm like going, I really have no idea, but here's how I did it. And if you can take things and frame it in a way that isn't like all, now, you know, there's expertise, which, you know, you then have the ability and the right to some degree, if someone asked you to share that expertise with people. But I think in general, each person will just take the mentality that you are a mentor, even if the people that you're mentoring, it's not official, but they're watching you. And you also are watching other people out there in the world, and you're copying them. You're taking little tidbits and nuggets from the way they live their life, and you're implementing those into your life. They never said to you, hey, you should do this. Because the second they do that, we kind of go like, hey, don't tell me what to do. Like, yeah, it's just
you get defensive quickly.
Yeah. We're super complicated that way. We don't like to be told. We want to come to the conclusion on our own. And, you know, and I think that, you know, I'll finish with this on this point. In sobriety, when I first got sober all those decades ago, I went into the bars, man. I wanted to pull all my drunk and drugged friends out of the bars and introduce them to this new amazing life, right? And they all, I won't tell you what they said because, you know, we'll get bleeped, but like, they basically told me to mind my own business is what they really said. Well, years later, some of them a couple years, some of them a couple decades, one by one, they came to me when they were ready and they said, how do I make a change? That was because I was willing to very visibly share the way I was going about it, even with all warts and all, as we say. And I think that that's the thing. I don't have all the answers. I can't tell anybody else how to get sober. I can tell you, you know, if you want to be sober, don't drink. You know, I mean, it's in a weird way, it's not more complicated than that, but of course it is more complicated. And you, community matters. You have to surround yourself with people that are beacons and not anchors. I got a veteran friend of mine, a Green Beret, who gives a great talk on beacons and anchors. And sometimes it's the people closest to you in your life, family and friends, who are pulling you back into the abyss. And it's not because they don't love you. It's because they're afraid of how your recovery and you getting better is going to affect them. You might go on to leave them. Because you've now found this whole new thing. So they want the best for you, but they also want you to stay with them. And it's it's not as simple very often as getting sober. Almost everybody stays sober in rehab, but the reason that, you know, relapse rates are so high, I mean, over 90%, is that pretty much everybody goes right back into the same circumstance or environment that they left. So you have to find ways to change all of that. So I guess the point of all of that is attraction over promotion. Share your life openly with other people, just like you guys do here, and they will be attracted. They'll be interested. The second we turn that corner and tell people how they should live, we lose them.
Yeah, I couldn't love that more. And honestly, a couple of things that you said that I wanted to point out, you know, I've been working with people of all ability levels for my whole adult life and career. And two of the most important phrases I learned you should never say are, I know what you're going through, because that's never fair to say to another person, because each of us is different. We handle things differently. And you should... right? And you can, I love what you said, offer what worked for you, offer to be a support system for somebody else and help them find what's right for them. But I say this all the time, Charlie, none of us have the answers. We have the answers that worked for us. And as humans, each and every person, everybody that we idolize on the internet and on TV and movies and everywhere else in life, every single one of us show up every day just trying to figure it out. That's it. Nobody has the answers. There's no cookbook for this. And I love that you talked about just don't drink and how simple that message is. And that could be that simple for you, but for somebody else, there's a lot that goes into it. I get it. It's about offering that support, understanding that there is no cookbook approach that works for all of us. There's no magic pill in any of this. You have to meet the person where they're at and help them discover what's going to work best for them. And it might change dozens of times throughout their journey and their process. And that's okay. That's okay. Something might work for a day. It might work for a year. It might work for a decade, but then it might have to change. And that's okay. It's not a failure if you have to pivot and turn and find something else. So, I mean, I love all of that. I would love to talk to you about the ultra marathoning. I mean, you run distances that I don't even like to drive, I'll be honest. And I think that our listeners would really benefit from hearing how you got started in ultra marathoning. And I know that it was pivotal in helping you with your addiction. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah. Well, if it makes you feel any better, I don't like to drive that far either. So, and weirdly, people assume that I love running. I don't even like to run that much. I mean, the thing is, what I love is what running does for me. It's a vehicle, you know, it's a vehicle to a mindset. It's a vehicle to nature and to being outside and all of those things. That's really the greater point. Now, and not to get too nuanced or deep in the weeds here, but when I first got sober, I had been a runner. Even through my addictive years, I would clean up once in a while, and I used running as part of my toolkit towards getting healthy again during that period of time. So when I got sober, I was familiar with running, and I ran something like 30 marathons in the first few years of sobriety. And the joke I always tell is because clearly I had that whole addiction thing under control, and people would call me out sometimes and say, looks like you switched addictions. And to our previous point, I will always say, you know, I never sold my car to enter a marathon, but I did that to buy dope. So I'm pretty sure this is better. And, you know, occasionally people want to critique what you're doing and how you're doing it, because from the outside, there's a variety of reasons they might do that. But I thought that I needed to get rid of the addictive part of my personality. So I ran really hard every day. And part of that was making myself feel anything. Like, I wanted to hurt. I liked the control that I had of going out for a run. And I could get right to that edge, and I could push over it, and I could pull back from it. And I liked the control that I had of the pain threshold that I was in. And it took me years to get to where I slowly changed to the joy and the happiness of being outside. And while the running still might hurt some, I found ultra running was slow motion exploration. I've run across something like 40 countries, like all the way across them. And part of what I get to do when I'm doing that is to experience a culture, a country, the landscape, the people in very slow motion. And both of you guys know what I'm talking about. If you drive if somewhere in Africa in the Sahara Desert, and you drive into a village in a Land Cruiser, everybody gets running towards you with their hand out, because it's not their fault. They're programmed to know, oh, hey, here comes an opportunity for me to maybe ask for something and get something. You run into that same village with a backpack on your back or bike into it, people are looking at you like, what? What is this? And then they're laughing and having fun, and they just want to be part of it. And it like changes the whole dynamic. And most of the world is on foot or on bikes or some other, you know, modality. And so what it ultimately ended up doing for me was giving me a chance to experience humanity from ground level, where sometimes, I mean, nothing like Steve, but I was occasionally in danger. I mean, some of my danger was environmental. Most of the real danger I faced in my life has been from humans. And I think that's the nature of it. But you make the best decisions that you can about where to go. And I wouldn't trade, you know, I wouldn't give up any of the danger that I faced because I'd be giving up the nature that I got to experience.
I love that. Steve, I see you nodding along. What do you think?
You know, we can all build these layers that help build us up, right? And they're sources of strength, right? And so when we choose to engage, right? I guess to me, I'd make a quick point. We have to choose. Some of us get decision fatigue. Some of us are kind of frozen. We're in our routine, whatever that routine may be, and we don't even choose to take advantage of an opportunity, right? So, you know, listening, take advantage of an opportunity that's presented to you, right? Sometimes we just need to take a gamble and say, yes, like, yeah, I'll go take that walk with you. You've never invited me out before, but I'm going to take the chance to make a new friend, to go take an interesting hike or a walk or a bike or a run. You know, a paddle, like where I'm around, you know, it's like, we've got to be willing to experience the world and willing to experience nature and willing to experience sometimes that burning sensation in our muscles and be able to extrapolate the joy. Right. And that's what I'm hearing, you know, a lot out of you, Charlie, is like you found joy, right? And that, I think, finding joy can help pull us out of the depths, out of the darkness, out of the addictive cycle, right? And like you said, to your point, it's if we can find something that's actually a healthier addiction, we will just continue to incrementally get better in the ways that we choose, right? But we have to actively choose, like, all right, you know, cool, I'm able to now, instead of doing this maybe highly negative practice, whatever it may be, substances or not, instead of engaging in that negative practice, I'm going to go over here and I'm going to engage in this positive practice that at least helps me feel the way that I want to feel. I can gain some joy. I can gain some new experiences around the world or my community. We all want to be happy. I think just about everybody wants to be happy. I mean, I don't know. I've known a couple of real world nihilists, but not too many, you know? And even then, even the nihilists that I know, they want to go commiserate with other nihilists. So they're still seeking community. You know, in their own ways, but like, you know, finding joy sometimes is elusive, right? And so I'm grateful for Charlie being able to find his joy because he can be an example to any of us who are still sort of, you know, fumbling and bumbling our way around and saying, yeah, maybe I find some joy over here. Maybe not, you know, maybe I'll find a little bit of joy over here with this group of people. And oh no, I just, you know, something negative happened and I got to find a new one. But like being able to adapt, being able to flow, within different relationships, right, is usually pretty darn enriching. And it sounds like you had a lot of fun running across the Sahara Desert. That's got to be a very unique journey in and of itself. I'm really, really curious if you'd be willing to share a little bit more about that, you know, experience with us.
Yeah, dude, thank you for all that you just said. That was wonderful. And I like what popped into my head, and I've said it often, but it's voluntary, like chosen hardship is the best kind. And that chosen hardship prepares you for when the hardship comes out of the blue. You know, and if you've never, you know, experienced it in a, you know, my running, it's cool and it's interesting, but it's not, I'm not curing cancer while I'm out there running. Like I'm doing it for me because I need it. The Sahara was an interesting, at that point in my life, I was about 12 or 13 years sober. I was a senior producer for a TV show called Extreme Makeover Home Edition at that point in my life, which most everybody saw. So I had, you know, addicts are the best salespeople on the planet because we can convince people of just about anything. Usually we can convince people, I promise I'll never do that again. But, you know, I had gotten a job I was completely unqualified for and I rocked it. You know, I got into an amazing position with the top show on television and worked for a few years. At the same time, I was one of the top ultra distance runners in the world, running 100 milers and big races, Eco Challenge back in the day. Like all my teammates were SEALs and Rangers, and I did very well in all of those things. And I had this idea to run across the Sahara, and, you know, and it was an idiotic, aspirational, made no sense. What, why do something like this? Part of it was ego. You know, it's hard to find things in the adventure world that haven't been done before. And no one had ever run across the Sahara, turns out, for a pretty good reason. And I found a director named James Mall who came on board, and he had won the best documentary Oscar a couple of years before I met him. He agreed to come on board this project. He knew Matt Damon. They had been wanting to work together on a project, and he called me a week later and he's like, Matt wants to executive produce and to narrate this film. Like, Hans Zimmer came on board to do the score. Wow. Ultimately.
Wow.
But to be clear, I had three Academy Award winners attached to a project about me running across deep sand, like really, really riveting stuff. And, you know, and we're there a year and a half later in Senegal at the coast of Atlantic Ocean in Senegal, and I'm surrounded by people and we're getting ready to start the next day. And everybody's so excited. And all I can think is that I've suckered all of these people out here to the Sahara and we're all going to die. And within days, it's 140 degree ground temperatures and support vehicles are blowing up and people are quitting and my teammates are on IVs every day. And it feels impossible. And this goes back to something we were talking about a little while ago, but I think one of the detrimental things that people do to themselves is we have created this atmosphere of expectations of outcomes. So we focus on the outcome and try to reverse engineer our way into getting through it. And that's what I was doing in the Sahara, because I felt a lot of pressure to be successful, to get this whole team across 5,000 miles of the Sahara Desert. Like, that was my job. And it took all the joy out of it. And a week into it, we're falling apart. And I realized, you know, the lessons of sobriety. Like, the only miles that I could run were the ones right in front of me. And if I just focused on running a marathon in the morning, take a break, run a second marathon in the afternoon, and I do that every single day without getting carried away about what's next and what country's next and what problems are next, that we would slowly, incrementally make our way across the desert. And that's what happened. And when it was all over, you know, I ran two marathons a day for 111 consecutive days without taking a day off across, you know, the world's biggest, hottest, painful, deep sand desert.
Good grief.
You know, the physical undertaking was massive, but we created H2O Africa. And people, you know, again, I didn't ask for a dime. I never solicited a single dollar, yet it came just pouring in, pardon the water pun. And, you know, and we realized we were over our heads, another water pun. And, you know, we turned it into water.org because we needed to create a larger entity. I mean, water.org today, we've raised more than $1.3 billion and we've deployed something like $4 billion. Because we do a lot of deal making. And the point is, I only wanted to know if I could run across the Sahara Desert. I got the chance to unplug completely from anything and be singularly focused on one mission every single day, to run. And that was such a joy and a blessing, and pick your word. It was amazing, because that's what we miss when we don't go into nature. Or we take our phones into nature, or we do this, you know, we just set ourselves up for failure by never disconnecting and allowing our systems to reset. And Sahara was a big reset for me. And it changed my view of everything, of the planet, of my own existence on it. And I also realized one final thing that I think is really important. We think other people care about what we're doing way more than they actually do. We all basically care about one thing, ourselves.
Absolutely.
So people feel shy about trying something new, or I don't want to go out there and do this. What if I fail? Who cares? Like, there's nobody cares if you fail. I mean, that would be, we so overrate our own importance. And so just get outside. Breathe the fresh air, be out there doing something hard on purpose, and see what happens.
I love that so much. Everything you just said, I could talk about every single point that you just mentioned for a week. But a couple of things, I agree with you that nobody cares, but this current generation, the last couple of generations, the social media generations. It's so funny. I saw something the other day that said, when I was growing up, I had a diary and I used to get upset if anybody tried to read it. And now my kids, and this is their words, not mine, my kids post everything online and get mad if other people don't read it and post their stuff too. So it's been such a huge dynamic shift. I love what you said about two hard things. And for the listeners, before we hit record, Steve and I were talking about that very concept about doing hard things before Charlie even joined the call. And as soon as Charlie came on, one of the first things he said was, I'm just a guy that likes to do hard things. So I'm a big proponent of that. The populations I've worked with, I constantly say that resilience is a buzzword right now for a reason, because there's a million resilience programs out there. Resilience can't just be learned. I can't just tell you how to be resilient. Resilience has to be learned and earned. You have to do hard things. You have to realize that you're going to fail and fall. You have to figure out how to pick yourself up and do it differently to not fall again. I mean, you can have that knowledge and develop those skills along the way, but you have to learn it and earn it. So I'm really glad you talked about that. And I'm really glad you talked about outcomes, Charlie, because that's, you know, doing performance psych for 20 years with some of the most elite groups on the planet, that's one thing that I constantly say, and I say it every day. We have very little control over the outcome, any outcome, because it's usually a lot of outside of us factors that go into that outcome. All we can ever really control is what we say, think, and do, and our process. So if we focus on the outcome, we're chasing something that doesn't even exist, to be honest. It's the future. Future doesn't exist. We create it every moment with every choice we make. So really focusing on that process. And as you said, when you run, it's just the next step. You've got this idea of where you want to go, but I'm sure your route changed along the way. I'm sure you did things differently than what you set out and planned to do. And that's just life. Every one of us, everyone listening, everyone on this call, we've all had to pivot. We've all had to make changes. We've all had to adjust our course. As long as we're focusing on our process, then we're going to get more of what we want in the direction that we want to go. And we might realize that we never really wanted to go there in the first place. We might change our direction and end up miles past where we thought we were going to be. So I think that that's fantastic. I do want to make sure that I'm honoring your time. I would love to ask you, do you have any advice for someone? I know it's unfair to say you should, but if there's anyone listening who might be struggling or dealing with some sort of an addiction, whether it be substances or technology or anything else, what advice do you have for that person as far as the initial getting help step?
Well, you really nailed it earlier, but it comes back to community. And there's no, there is no stigma. Is, I'm not saying it's imagined. I'm not that naive, but that stigma is very often self-imposed. And it goes to what I just said, even that person who's sitting there at home struggling with addiction right now thinks that if they come out and say it publicly or they ask somebody else, they're going to get judged. In fact, what happens in the vast majority of cases, I mean, all of them, as far as I know, they will get compassion, they will get help, they will get somebody. We give other people purpose when we allow them to help us. You know, it's another one of those great skills. Very often people offer things to me. It's something I had to learn years ago because I'm a stubborn, you know, self-sufficient, I can do all of this myself thing. So even when somebody asks me if they can do this thing for me or do this act for me, even though I don't need them to do it necessarily, I try to always say yes. If it's something they genuinely want to give me from their heart, let them do it. That's not implying that I can't do it. It's implying that they want to do it for me. And so let them. So that idea translates really well to the person who's struggling. Get out of your own way. Recognize that nobody's coming to save you. If you want to be that strong, tough guy or girl, you can still be that person because you can recognize that in your mind and in your action, you have to take the first step. Then an entire community will enfold you, will help you, will support you, will encourage you. And if there's people in that community that are criticizing you, that's what we call anchors. And there's a line on an anchor and you can cut that. And like, I mean, I don't have time for that stuff. You know, it's not that the world is all sunshine and butterflies and it's all lifting up. But generally speaking, we are a reflection of who we hang out with, of who we talk to. Like, I mean, that's just the nature of it. And so I would say one final thing, which is that person is not broken. You know, what happens to us isn't nearly as important as what we do about it. And we confuse and conflate all of those past things because we know those and we look forward and we think we're still going to be projecting those things into the future. And it's a one step at a time, one day at a time process where slowly but surely all of that baggage falls off the train, man. It does. But you've got to start. And the best way is to get outside. You know, go for a walk. I think all therapy should be done while you're walking.
Couldn't agree with you more.
If you're on the phone, I have a therapist. I tell her, she's in California. I'm like, hey, we're going for a walk together. You know, we both put on our headphones and we go for a walk. And it's so much more energetic and robust. And the ideas are great. Whereas if I could have done this on the move, I would have. We need to figure out podcasting on the move.
Oh, 1,000%.
Sure.
Yeah, we've said that since day one. You know, I was just at a big university a couple of weeks back talking to their mental health department, and they were so hungry for ways to do more work outside. And they gave me a million different reasons why they haven't been able to and the challenges with the administration and everything that they would face. And it was just about listening and about helping them work through it, just like we would with anybody else, with anything else. And that was really exciting for me because I agree, you know, ecotherapy is such a huge way forward for mental health. I couldn't agree more. Gosh, you keep saying stuff that I just want to talk about forever. Definitely, I'm going to go ahead and say it, Steve. We want to have you back on, Charlie. We haven't even talked about a lot of your current work, which I'm super excited about. So go ahead and, you know, start thinking about another time to come on now, because I know getting on your calendar, you're doing so much good stuff in the world. I know that I'm going to have to put in my request now, but I would love to have you back on.
I'll make time for this. I needed to make sure, you know, that I'm jokingly saying I needed to make sure this was going to be fun, but there's so much happening right now. And there's a new cognitive behavioral therapy program that I'm working on with a team that is actually going to impact veterans and people. It's actually called Anonymous Health, even, which is I think it's one of the best names ever of, you know, basically getting rid of bad habits. But there's a lot of great things, and it is that balance of technology and, but we have to have interesting conversations that don't pass judgment on other people and that welcome them under this tent that we're occupying.
I couldn't love that more. I'm so excited to hear more about this. Just to be a good steward of time, if you're okay with it, I'd love to switch to the part of the show we call the Fast Five.
Uh-oh. Yeah. I remember seeing that was going to be it, and I tried not to overthink it since okay. I have no idea what it is. So,
well, five quick questions. Just shoot from the hip. Answer as quickly as you can. Where's your favorite spot to get outside?
Yosemite is easily the top answer for me. It's a magical place.
Yeah. And first place that was actually thought about to be used for health and wellness as far as managed lands.
I just read the book about John Muir and the creation of Yosemite. So it's top of mind right now. And I go there every year, and I took my kids there every year for a very long time.
I love it. What's your preferred outdoor activity?
Hiking. I prefer to hike more than I like to run. You know, hiking is observational. If you're running trails, even as good as I am at it, you're still staring at the ground half the time.
Yeah, I love that. I was just talking to a gentleman in the state park the other day. We were talking about the Appalachian Trail, and he said, oh, did you hear about the guy that just did it in like obscene amount of time? And yeah. I said, yeah, I feel bad for him because the whole experience went by so quick. Yeah. You know, and I've talked to so many through hikers that just saw the world from a different perspective that they normally wouldn't. And you mentioned that, Charlie, you know, running through the Sahara and different areas of the world and different villages, and it gives you that perspective. Same can be said for taking a train instead of an airplane. It could be said for, you know, taking a canoe down a canal and seeing parts of a city that you would never get to see in a car or an Uber or a bus or anything else. So I think that that's fantastic. What's your favorite food to eat outside?
My favorite food to eat outside would be, it's always going to be fruit, any kind of fruit. You mentioned plant-based. I've been plant-based for 25 years. So it sounds interesting. I was just in the Amazon. I told you this before the show, in Ecuador with a tribe that's never had contact with the outside world in general. And I got a chance to be, you know, they have no electricity or refrigeration or anything else. So when you're eating something, A, you have to go get it. you know, and B, it is truly, you know, fresh. And there's nothing like being in nature and eating something that nature made. You know, I'm not being judgmental here when I say this, maybe I am, but I don't count animals in that. For me, I want to commune with nature by, you know, consuming nature when I'm out there. Now, I got across the Sahara and I will admit to wanting a pizza. It was vegetarian.
I'm not going to fault you with that. I love it.
Yeah,
I love it. And hopefully I put your mind at ease a little bit with these questions. You see that I'm not asking you to do long division or anything. So the next one, do you have a favorite animal?
I do have a favorite animal. So I grew up with a lot of dogs and cats, and I think cats are much maligned. I love cats more than I like dogs even. And it's not a popular answer a lot of times, but the reason is there's an unknown independence. You know, you walk in the door with a dog and you actually know what that dog's going to do every single day. You walk in the door and you got a cat, you better be on the lookout. Some days that cat's rubbing up against your legs, and other days it's like, well, I don't want anything to do with you. And I sort of relate to that independent mindedness.
Steve, that sings to your heart.
I'm right there with you, Charlie. I have two cats about 6 feet away from me. One is just about 20 years old and quite aggressive and violent. And the other is he's just over a year old. He's 14 pounds and almost 3 feet long. He's a Maine Coon.
Wow.
You know, and he's just as gentle of a giant as you could ever imagine. So
I got to see a picture of that cat. So I'll share. We'll exchange cat pictures. There you
Heck
go.
Yeah.
So.
There you go. I mean, that's half the content on the internet. So, yeah, you know, we're a good company.
Steve, we need to start keeping track too. Cats versus dogs are guest answers.
I bet we could start a research project on that.
There we go. Always the researcher. Number five, if you could only go to one outdoor spot for the rest of your life, what would it be? That's the tough one.
The jungle, no doubt. Oh. So, and I say it partly because of my wife. I told you guys a little bit about my wife, but you know, she lived in the Amazon jungle for years and she's taken me there and I've gotten to see it through her eyes. And while I love deserts, I love mountains, the biodiversity of just 1 square mile of jungle, it so eclipses any other ecosystem on the planet for diversity of wildlife and bugs and plants and trees. And like, you could spend a lifetime in 1 square mile in the jungle and you would never get a complete list of everything that's there. And so that's definitely my favorite spot.
I love that so much. One bonus question. Do you have a favorite nature quote, saying, or idiom?
Okay, I will admit to cheating on this one because you gave me a heads up on this one. And so I had to, you might imagine, I mean, I'm a writer. There's quotes throughout my book. I am a big quote, like there's sticky notes all over my life.
You're singing to my heart now.
Yeah. And so, of course, anything that John Muir said almost ever is something that I could put on a sticky note and put it on a wall somewhere in my house. But I chose one from Thich Nhat Hanh, who is, you know, again, one of my favorite writers he was, and I just loved everything, and I'll just read it. The mind can go in 1,000 directions, but on this beautiful path, I walk in peace. With each step, the wind blows. With each step, a flower blooms. Okay, that's very flowery and woo-woo and everything else, but it actually says,
yeah, it's perfect.
Everything, you know, it says everything. If you can be in nature and just get out of your own way and pay attention to the sounds and the feels and everything about it, it reminds me too. I get out of nature every single day because I do need to be reminded that all the other parts of my life are not actually very important. And my physical and mental well-being are top of the list. Because if I don't take care of those things, I can't be of service to other people.
Yeah, I love that. And we're both huge Thich Nhat Hanh fans. So, you know, flowery and everything else that you just said, we're okay with that. So,
perfect.
We see it as being human.
Yeah.
Charlie, do you have any parting words for the listeners about how nature truly impacts our health and well-being?
So I work with a lot of addicts, and I'm going to term it this way. The first thing that an addict does, and I'm working to change this, but when they go into rehab is they get sat down in a plastic chair and people start talking to them from day one, talk therapy, which can be extremely effective. However, and this is the proof of it, if you take that same person and you just take them out for a 30-minute walk every single day before you sit them in a chair and talk to them, you will exponentially change their lives. You'll change the nature of the conversations you're having. And that works for anyone, anytime. I'll leave you with my old high school coach's favorite saying in running. And he just said, there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing.
Yeah. I love what you said. And we've seen that, you know, with so many different populations, not just with addiction. Healthcare is like that, right? We love to sit people in sterile environments. And for some conditions, we need that. But I agree. And there's so much science to back up exactly what you just said. Just get people outside. And, you know, it changes their biochemistry, their body and brain, opens them up, helps to regulate emotions. So many different, I mean, we could talk all day just about the benefits, but I agree with you. That's such good advice. Steve, do you have any parting words for Charlie?
As a fellow addict, I'm a person who struggled with a lot of different addictive behaviors. And it took me, you know, over a decade to figure out that that's actually what I was struggling with. I can highly oversimplify some of the success of your story, right? And it sounds to me in my head of like, just take that next step, be willing to take a step in a direction that we think will help us, maybe help ourselves, maybe help our family, or maybe, you know, help the world, right? It sounds like you took a lot of steps and you built a $1 billion water project for a lot of people on a whole other continent, right? And so I just really, really deeply admire that. I think that's just such a wonderful way to channel your humanity, your energy, and then help show others, right? That none of these ideas are necessarily impossible, right? If we have ideas to help ourselves, ideas to help others, they're not impossible. We have to believe, we have to be willing to take that step. And sometimes we never, ever realize just how amazing the outcome, which we cannot predict, right? We have to be willing to take that step to potentially maybe achieve some amazing outcome for both ourselves and our communities. So thank you for being so motivated in caring for yourself and caring for others around you, because you're making waves. You've already made huge, huge ripples in this giant pond of the earth. I say this to a lot of our guests, but I really, really hope to find a way to spend some time with you in person in the future, because I want to learn more. I want to know more. I'd love to have a, you know, cup of tea with you at some point, maybe out in the woods.
Thank you, brother. Yeah, no, thank you for saying that to both of you. And I know that's going to happen. My joke is always be careful what you ask for, because I've still got a lot of really bad ideas of things that I still want to do. So you'll get sucked into the vortex, but you know, there's always a lesson, and I don't do hard things for nothing. I do them because there's lessons buried in those things. And you guys do an amazing job of shining a light on that kind of thing. So thank you.
That's so great. And Steve, I noticed the other water pun there with making waves and ripples. And
I got them all. They were great. Well done.
Charlie, just the fact that you built this company and it's thriving, not just staying afloat. There's one more. It's pretty impressive. But, you know, I want to echo something Steve said. I just want to thank you for your humanity. And that's what I'm hearing in everything that you're saying. You are sharing ideas. You are sharing things that helped you. You are sharing inspiration, but you're sharing your humanity, which is becoming more and more rare these days as we're becoming polarized and isolated and divided. And I think that the more that people can hear from folks like you and to hear your story and to hear what's possible, I can't help but think that there's hope for us. And I'm excited about that. And Steve, to something you just said, I want everybody listening to remember that every single thing that's ever happened in our world started as one idea from one person. So if you have an idea and you really want to go after it, nothing should stop you. And I love this so much. Charlie, I would love to spend more time with you. Steve, you're only going to be better for being with him in person. I can tell you that. I just had a few minutes with him, but he impacted me greatly. I just want you to know that, Charlie, and thanks so much for taking a few minutes today to be with us. This has been fantastic.
Great pleasure. Thank you, guys.
And for everybody listening at home, please do your health and well-being the best favor you can and just get outside.
Thank you for listening to the Nature of Wellness podcast, hosted by Dr. Mark A. Campbell and Steve Otero. Follow us on Instagram at Nature of Wellness, with new content being added frequently. Be sure to like, comment, and subscribe wherever you listen. The content of this podcast is for general information purposes only. Nothing should be taken as legal or medical advice. The information is not intended to replace the guidance of your healthcare providers, but to create an outlet for new discussions with them.